The Tolkien Road, Episode 234, The Book of Lost Tales 1, Part 3. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 234, The Book of Lost Tales 1, Part 3. Greta, what's up?
Hey. March Madness is up.
Yep.
Thank God we got our March Madness back.
Yeah. Yeah, missed it last year, for sure.
For real. Especially for people like us that are like football and baseball fans. You know, the early winter months are kind of empty as far as sports go. So March Madness is it's a little oasis for us. It's nice that it's back.
Indeed. You speak the truth.
I do.
And it was when we lost March Madness last year, that was kind of the moment I was like, oh, this is
real. Yeah. Like this is serious.
It was unprecedented for sure. So it's nice to have it with us this year for sure. So.
Yeah. It's not the same, you know, cause the stands are mostly empty and whatever. So that's taking a little bit away from it, but
the atmosphere,
you know,
a little bit
the atmosphere, yeah, the feel,
yeah.
But the players are certainly bringing their A game, so
yeah,
that's cool.
Cool,
it's fun.
All it's right,
fun. Yeah.
Well, this has been College Basketball with John and Greta. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
On this
over and out.
On this episode, we are continuing our survey of the history of Middle Earth as we examine the last six chapters of the Book of Lost Tales 1. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lisa Yu, Andrew T, John R, and Ms. Anonymous. Thank you all so much.
Yes, thank you guys.
And thank you to all of our patrons.
Mm-hmm.
You too. That's right, I'm talking to you.
The personal.
Me?
You.
Yes, you. You too can become a patron of the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks like video recordings of our episodes so you can see every reaction on our faces as we make them.
You make it sound like it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it always is.
We both have some pretty funny reactions, you know, along the way. So, yeah.
Well, you know, I guess we do. We do.
Mm-hmm.
And last episode I did do jumping jacks, which people could see if they were video subscribers.
That's interesting.
Well, the top part of...
That's interesting. I don't remember that.
Well, it was really just my arms.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about exercise books. Anyway, if you want to see that...
Oh, yeah, exercise books.
And
that's
all,
right.
All the wonderfulness that entails. Yeah. Be a patron.
Yeah, there was somebody... Speaking of the exercise books, there was somebody who told... Who was it? Somebody told me that they... Did I tell you this, that they thought we were talking about actual exercise books as well?
No way! I have a kindred spirit out there?
Who was it? Let's see
here. I
don't
know. You didn't tell me this.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of when I saw it. Because I didn't put it in the course. I didn't mark it for correspondence this week. But
it's messed up.
Definitely somebody said that. Was it over on Twitter that somebody said that? Let's see here.
Well, we don't need to spend time looking for it now if it's not on the... tip of your mouse, so to speak.
Shoot, well, I just it was such a funny moment that I feel like it's worth it's worth revisiting, so I'm gonna try and find it here if I can.
Well, I don't know, I'm running out of things to keep up our airspace noise.
Yeah, well,
I don't like dead airspace.
I'm gonna remember who it was here after we finish recording.
Well, it makes me feel good to know that I wasn't alone.
Yeah. It definitely made me laugh when I got that email. And then it made me question, like, maybe I was the wrong one. But anyway.
Maybe you were.
Yeah, well, maybe I was.
Maybe.
I very well could have been wrong. But yes, patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Become a patron, please. Tip, you can also support the Tolkien Road by leaving us a one-time tip. Just look in the show notes on your podcatcher for the Leave a Tip link, or head on over to TolkienRoad.com and look for the blue Leave a Tip button. iTunes or your whatever podcast app you use, subscribe, rate, and review. Leave a 5-star rating and a review and help us get the word out, please. And then YouTube. Subscribe and get notified on YouTube. Click that subscribe button. Click that bell over on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Tolkien Road.
Have you put a video up recently?
No, but I've got a couple in the works. Yeah. So, yep, trying to get back on that horse.
Awesome.
All right. So, yeah, Tolkien quote of the week. This is from letter 73. This is a letter that Tolkien, another letter that Tolkien wrote to his son Christopher during World War II. And this is kind of a similar thing to what we had last week, where they're discussing, Tolkien happens to mention like his own creative output during his war experience and how it was helping him make sense of what was going on around him. So he says to Christopher, and this is from letter 73 on the 10th of June, 1944. I tried a diary with portraits, some scathing, some comic, some commendatory, of persons and events seen, but I found it was not my line. So I took to escapism, or really transforming experience into another form and symbol with Morgoth and orcs and the Eldalie, representing beauty and grace of life and artifact, and so on. And it has stood me in good stead in many hard years since, and I still draw on the conceptions then hammered out. But, of course, there was no time except on leave or in hospital. Yeah. So, just again, we're seeing, you know, where these things we're discussing with the Book of Lost Tales really came from, right? So much of it came from Tolkien trying to make sense of his wartime experience, you know, to some degree. Of course, there were other sources for it as well, but maybe the energy behind it and him doing all this work, which apparently was quite a bit, came from those experiences and in trying to make some sense in an escapist form of what he was, what he was seeing, what he was feeling from World War One. So
I think there's so many lessons we can learn from Tolkien, but I feel like that's a really big one, trying to turn something that on the surface, and in all truth, is quite ugly, like war.
Absolutely.
But
yeah.
Kind of using it for, you know, transforming it and using that experience for something really beautiful and good.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that if we all made the effort to do that more often, it would be a good thing.
Word.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right. So, correspondence, stick around to the end of the episode as we will discuss some of the correspondence we have recently received. Greta, you ready to dive into the last part of the Book of Lost Tales?
I've been ready.
Or at least Book of Lost Tales 1.
Born ready.
Let's do this.
Okay.
So last week we looked at the first four chapters of the Book of Lost Tales 1 and discovered the frame narrative called The Cottage of Lost Play and the main character, Ariel, through whose eyes we experience many of the legends that we will eventually come to know from the Silmarillion. On this episode, we will be looking at the last six chapters of Volume 1. As a reminder, each chapter is laid out as follows. There's an introductory description of where the main contents of the chapter are found, and this is where the high school exercise book comes in, right? So beside all those pictures of jumping jacks and other calisthenics, he was jotting down all these notes.
That was probably the version written by Richard Simmons, would be my guess.
Richard Simmons, yes, indeed. Sweating to the oldies, yes.
Yep. In book form.
That's right.
Who knew it existed?
Amazing.
I bet Tolkien did the illustrations.
For the exercise book? Mm-hmm. Maybe. This is getting weird.
We should probably move on.
This is getting weird. All right. All right. So then we have, with each chapter, we have the introductory description and then Christopher's transcription of his father's writings, notes and commentary by Christopher, and then additional relevant material and commentary. So not necessarily a direct part of the Book of Lost Tales, but maybe things that Christopher found along the way that seemed appropriate to share in that particular chapter.
This was quite a project for him to undertake.
I can only imagine.
It makes my head spin.
I can only imagine, to be quite honest, like what, how intensive this work was. Because I don't know, like, I don't think the elder Tolkien was a particularly organized person. So
many creatives are not.
Well,
I am not organized and I'm also not a creative. Mm-hmm. So I can't even use that excuse, which is unfortunate. But I feel like a lot of creatives are, like, organization is just not their strong suit.
Yeah.
So it's good that Tolkien had a son like Christopher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure. So, maybe we need to preface every episode of this series by just saying, giving a salute to Christopher for all of the work that went into this. So
for sure,
because it seems like the kind of work that would give you headaches trying to put it all together, because it requires so much focus.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the structure of each chapter. We did the last four chapters last time. Now let's talk about chapter five. Chapter five is the coming of the elves and the making of Kor. So just a quick word on what Kor is. I think we may have mentioned this on the last episode, but Kor is shorthand for Kortirion, and it was the principal city of Tol Eressëa near Aman. The city was located on a great hill at the very center of the island in the region of Alal Menore, the land of elms. The cottage of Lost Play was located somewhere outside the city. Yeah. So, and this is something that doesn't show up in the Silmarillion, in the final published form of the Silmarillion. So just wanted you all to know what that word was, since it's in the chapter title there. This chapter roughly corresponds to chapter three of the Silmarillion, right? So we're talking about the coming of the elves. Okay. But there are several differences in the details. Again, we're surveying. We're not going to go nearly into all of the details, all of the differences. Our concern here is more just to give you a simple idea of what's contained in each of these chapters. All right, so the introduction to chapter five states, "I take this title from the cover of the book, which adds also how the elves did fashion gems. For as I have already remarked, the narrative continues without a new heading." So he's basically saying this continues from the previous chapter, which was the chaining of Melko, right? Where he found this, it continues from the previous chapter. Okay. That's the introduction. I'm going to read a little bit of the content here. So again, the frame is not something that just happens in the first chapter. It's not like there's just this setup of the frame narrative and then we never refer to the frame narrative again. The frame narrative goes throughout the Book of Lost Tales. Okay. It's almost like it again has that Princess Bride feel to it, where, they're like the frame narrative will interject itself into the stories that are being told from time to time, for whatever narrative, for whatever greater narrative purpose. This is an interesting thing. If you all want to pipe in, because I know the frame narratives are something that's used in a lot of different things, right? It's used in a lot of films. It's used in a lot of books. I'd love to hear from you guys, just as an aside, about what some of your favorite frame narratives are. All right. Outside of Tolkien, right? Whatever you want to throw at us. I happen to really like this as a narrative device. One of my favorite frame narratives is Joseph Conrad and his long short story / novella Youth. That's one of my all-time favorite works of literature, and that one employs, he did it a lot with the same characters actually, but that one employs a frame narrative and is a personal favorite of mine. Just as an aside, Greta, I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot with this.
You can are. You think of anything? I've been racking my brain.
Yeah.
And none are jumping out at me. I don't know that I've read a whole lot of books that use a frame narrative. I know it's pretty common. Can you give me some other examples, maybe?
Well, I will tell you that
I do love Princess Bride. I will say that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a movie.
I mean, that's the one that stands out most for me. In my mind, and I don't know that it's something that I feel like I would come up with a lot more if I really spent a lot more time thinking about it. It's another form of narration that removes the need for narration to be third party omniscient, right?
I really like it. I just feel like I haven't read a whole lot that have been written in that form. But I'll do a little research, maybe next episode.
Yeah.
I can come up with one.
Yeah, and for anybody who wants to chime in on what your favorite frame narrative works of art / film / literature, whatever they may be, just an interesting question since we're talking about these things. I will say to talk about another Tolkienian example, even though he didn't do this himself, with the Peter Jackson Hobbit films, they are told as a frame narrative, because Bilbo is basically talking to Frodo, right? After, like, before, just before, what would really in the context is the beginning of the Lord of the Rings, right? He's kind of writing this, all this down, in, I guess, what it turns out to be the Red Book of Westmarch. So,
okay.
Yeah. So it's employed in the film, in the Hobbit films. All right. Getting back to the coming, of the elves and the making of Kor. So this is a little bit of content, and I'm going to try and find sections from each chapter just to show the transition between the frame narrative and the actual legend being related. Then said Ariel, "Sad was the unchaining of Melko, methinks, even did it seem merciful and just. But how came the gods to do this thing?" Then Meryl, continuing, said, "Upon a time thereafter was the third person of Melko's imprisonment beneath the third period of Melko's imprisonment beneath the halls of Mondos come nearly to its ending. Manwë sat upon the top of the mountain and gazed with his piercing eyes into the shades beyond Valinor, and hawks flew to him and from him bearing many great tidings. But Varda was singing a song and looking upon the plain of Valinor. Silpion was at that time glimmering, and the roofs of Valmar below were black and silver beneath its rays. And Varda was joyous, but on a sudden Manwë spake, saying, 'Behold, there is a gleam of gold beneath the pine trees, and the deepest gloaming of the world is full of a patter of feet. The Eldar have come, O Tanaquetel.' Then Varda arose swiftly and stretched her arms out north and south and unbraided her long hair and lifted up the song of the Valar, and Ilwë was filled with the loveliness of her voice." So, that shows you how the transition there occurs between the frame narrative and the content of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So jumping ahead a little bit to Christopher's commentary on some of the differences here.
Differences between this and the Silmarillion?
Yeah,
or,
okay. Right. And what would come later, right?
Okay.
Christopher says, "I have already touched on the great difference in the structure of the narrative at the beginning of this tale, namely that here the elves awoke during Melko's captivity in Valinor, mm-hmm. whereas in the latter story, it was the very fact of the awakening that brought the Valar to make war on Melkor, which led to his imprisonment in Mondos. Thus, the ultimately very important matter of the capture of the elves about Quivienen by Melkor is necessarily entirely absent. The release of Melko from Mondos here takes place far earlier, before the coming of the elves' ambassadors to Valinor, and Melko plays a part in the debate concerning the summons." So that's an interesting little note, is that mm-hmm. this all happens before the awakening of the elves in the Book of Lost Tales, and Melko actually plays a role in debating like what the Valar are going to do with respect to the elves. So,
because he was not a bad guy yet.
Or they didn't know that he was a bad guy.
Or he was
secretly plotting
against
them.
In disguise. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
interesting.
Yeah, definitely interesting. There are a couple of poems in this chapter. So one of them is entitled simply Kor, and it's short enough to where I think we can read it. It's entitled, let me say this, in connection with, so this is Christopher's providing the commentary on this. He says, "In connection with this description of the city of the elves in Valinor, I give here a poem entitled Kor. It was written on April 30th, 1915. He says, and so the title is Kor in a City Lost and Dead. A sable hill, gigantic, rampart crowned, stands gazing out across an azure sea, under an azure sky on whose dark ground, impearled as gainst a floor of porphyry, gleam marble temples white and dazzling halls, and tawny shadows fingered long are made in fretted bars upon their ivory walls, by massy trees rock-rooted in the shade, like stony chiseled pillars of the vault, with shaft and capital of black basalt. There slow forgotten days forever reap the silent shadows counting out rich hours, and no voice stirs, and all the marble towers, white, hot, and soundless, ever burn in sleep." So
it's lovely.
Yeah.
I like that he used azure instead of blue.
He used it twice.
I know, he did. It just sounds much more poetic, I think.
Yeah.
And fancy.
It is.
I'm going to start using azure instead of blue.
I'm just going to.
Do you like my azure short shirt?
Yeah, people should. Well, you need to kind of lean back a little bit so you know people can see it.
Oh.
So, yeah, there you go.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm wearing Boy,
Greta,
azure.
That's a lovely azure shirt that
Thank
you're
you.
Wearing. Although I'm not sure if that's technically the color azure.
Oh, is it, like, or, is it a different shade of blue?
Yeah.
Like a,
let's see.
Like a more, oh,
I don't know.
It's also a company, apparently.
Looks pretty, no, it's a Microsoft thing. It's one of their, like,
oh,
little,
I think my shirt is
softwares.
Actually pretty close.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
It is pretty close. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just, it makes the, like, you use it in terms of the sky and the ocean, right?
Yeah.
So, I think that's very appropriate. Yeah.
Party on.
Yeah, party on.
There's another poem in this chapter entitled A Song of Areador. Yeah, so okay. A little context on this. I won't read this one. It's a little longer, but it's one definitely looks good. And he says, Christopher says of this one, I conclude this commentary with another early poem that bears upon the matter of this tale. It is said in the tale that men in Hisolome feared the lost elves, calling them the Shadow Folk, and their and that their name for the land was Areador. Hmm. This is spelled differently from the Areador of that we think of as being part of, you know, kind of the region where the, like the Hobbits, where the Shire is, right? So it's A-R-Y-A-D-O-R. So I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Areador. So maybe related to the later word. The meaning of this is given in the early Gnomish word list as land or place of shadow. The poem is called A Song of Areador and is extant in two copies. According to notes on these, it was written in an army camp near Litchfield on September 12th, 1915. It was never, to my knowledge, printed.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Cool.
Little piece of treasure there.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Chapter 6. So chapter 6, again, the intro, so chapter 6 is the theft of Melkor and the darkening of Valinor. This corresponds roughly to chapter 7 and chapter 8 of the Silmarillion. The introduction is short. It reads, this title is again taken from the cover of the book containing the text. The narrative, still written rapidly in pencil, with some emendations from the same time or later, continues without a break. All right, so we're just kind of being continuous here for these last several chapters. All right, let's see. Greta, do you want to read this mm-hmm. Read this section here that's a, you know, that's our kind of representative content for this chapter?
I'd be happy to, John.
Okay.
All right. Listen then, O Ariel, if thou wouldst know how it so came, that the loveliness of Valinor was abated, or the elves might ever be constrained to leave the shores of Eldamar, it may well be that you know already that Melko dwelt in Valinor, in Valimar, as a servant in the house of Tulkas in those days of the joy of the
Eldalie.
I knew that. Okay. There did he nurse his hatred of the gods and his consuming jealousy of the Eldar, but it was his lust for the beauty of the gems, for all his feigned indifference, that in the end overbore his patience and caused him to design deep and evilly. Nolduai alone at those times had the art of fashioning these beautiful things, and despite their rich gifts to all whom they loved, the treasure they possessed of them was beyond count the greatest. Wherefore Melko, whenever he may, consorteth with them, speaking cunning words. In this way, for long, he sought to beg gifts of jewels for himself, and maybe also catching the unwary to learn something of their hidden art. But when none of these devices succeeded, he sought to sow evil desires and discords among the gnomes, telling them that lie concerning the council when the Eldar were bidden to Valinor. Slaves are ye, he would say, or children, and you will bidden play in toys and seek not to stray or know too much. Good days, mayhap, the Valar give you, as ye say, seek but to cross their walls, and ye shall know the hardness of their hearts. Lo, they use your skill, and to your beauty they hold fast as an adornment of their realms. This is not love, but selfish desire. Make test of it. Ask for your inheritance, that Iluvatar designed for you. The whole wide world to roam, with all its mysteries to explore, and all its substances to be material of such mighty crafts as never can be realized in these narrow gardens penned by the mountains, hemmed in by the impassable sea.
All right. So, again, a little bit of representative content there, but we can see, you know, what we would see later in the Silmarillion, Melkor you know, once the elves are in Valinor, kind of working, like spreading lies, you know, trying to like kind of quietly pit them against the Valar and, and get them to view the Valar as, you know, as their enemies. Now, as far as a little bit of comment, a little bit of Christopher's commentary from this chapter on the key differences. So what he says is, the story of the corruption of the Noldoli by Melko was ultimately told quite differently. For there entered the matter of the strife between Finwë's sons Feanor and Fingolfin, of which in the tale there is no trace, and where, in any case, Feanor is not the son of Finwë, Noleme, but of one Bruithwir. The primary motive in the later story of Melko's desire for the Silmarils is here represented only by a lust for the gems of the Noldoli in general. It is indeed a remarkable feature of the original mythology that though the Silmarils were present, they were of such relatively small importance. There is essential agreement with the later story in its being the Noldoli at whom Melko aimed his attack, and there is a quite close, if limited, similarity in the arguments he used. The confinement of the elves in Valinor by the Valar and the broad realms in the east that were rightly heirs, but notably absent from Melko's words is any reference in the coming of men, or to the coming of men. This element is in the tale introduced later and quite differently by Manwë himself. Moreover, the particular association of the Noldoli with the evil Vala arises from his desire for their gems. In the Silmarillion, the Noldor turned to him for the instruction he could give, while the other kindreds held aloof. So, a little bit of the difference, you know, of the differences there between this older one and what we would have in the later Silmarillion. It's not so much about Melkor's lust for the Silmarils, you know, that's driving him to do this in this case. So there you go.
Good.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, you know, what we're seeing there is that the whole, I guess we're partly seeing why this isn't called the Silmarillion just yet, right? The Silmarils were maybe not as in focus as they would later be. It strikes me just kind of off the cuff right here that that's similar to like the One Ring, right? Because with the One Ring, of course, it was in the original version of The Hobbit, it was just kind of a magic ring, right? And it was almost just a little bit of a plot device within The Hobbit. And it wasn't until later that Tolkien decided to make the One Ring the big deal that it was, right? To really make it the focus of, you know, of that entire saga, right?
So can we kind of think of this Book of Lost Tales, like the deeper we get into it, can we maybe think of it as kind of like a rough draft of the Silmarillion?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, this is the, I mean, it's basically the original rough draft of the Silmarillion.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Good.
So
that helps me understand it a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting that he, I mean, that's kind of a big change, right? I mean, that to bring something in focus in the revised version that was kind of in the background in the original.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a big change.
Yeah.
But again, that's why rough drafts are a good thing, right? Because it just helps you kind of figure out what it is that you want the final product to look like.
Well, and I think for a lot of times creative processes are like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't necessarily set out to do like create something, whether it be a story, a work of art, a song, whatever it is, right?
A dish of food.
It might start with something as simple as like an opening line, like, you know, in the case of The Hobbit, right? In the Holy Ground there lived a hobbit, and you're just kind of like, you just want to chase that for a little bit, right? And where does it go? You know, when I write songs, I might be like, you know, oh, I like that riff, or I like that chord progression, you know, or I hear this kind of melody in my head, but I have no idea what it's about, right? And it's not till later that you really, if you go through the process of like drawing it out, kind of letting yourself kind of brainstorm with it and then editing it, right, and bringing it down, that you really find the core of what the story is all about, right? Or what the song is all about, or what the work of art is all about. You know, I think that's pretty much true of any creative process.
I think
right
true.
There's something that kind of makes you want to go there to that particular place and spend some time thinking about what's going on. And I think that's equally true of anything Tolkien himself created.
I think that's true. I think that's true. I think it's proof that rabbit trails are not always total wastes of time.
Yeah, or hobbit trails.
Or hobbit trails.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or Tolkien roads.
Right? Mm. Wow.
Yes.
I like where that went.
Mm-hmm.
That was good. That was a good progression.
Yeah.
Kind of like a good chord progression.
Mm. Pretty mm.
Well, yeah. Nice. We're rocking it.
Nailing it. All right. Chapter 7. The Flight of the Noldoli.
I'm really glad he... Can I just say real quick? I'm really glad he changed it from What is it?
Noldoli.
Noldoli to Noldor. Because I cannot say that word to save my life. Like, I want to say Nodoy. Like, I'm like, I just wanted that L and D, to, like, the Noldoli. L to be silent. And I can just say Noldoli.
And I keep going back and forth. Should it be Noldoli or Noldoli? I don't know.
Oh, Noldoli sounds better.
Hey, all you language people, help us out.
I'm just glad it's Noldor now.
Yeah.
Because there's no confusion there.
I hear you.
Yeah.
All right. Chapter 7, The Flight of the Noldoli. Intro, there is no break in Lindo's narrative, which continues on in the same hastily penciled form, and near this point passes to another similar notebook, clearly with no break in composition. But I've thought it convenient to introduce a new chapter or a new tale here, again taking the title from the cover of the book. So, yeah, we're continuing on to another similar notebook, and... Now, I'm a little confused by this, by what Christopher is saying here. Is he saying that he's kind of going somewhere else from where it actually continues to? I sometimes Christopher says things, and I'm not quite sure what he's saying. And it's actually also true of Tolkien, especially in this older day. But maybe someone else can make sense of that for me. Anyway, I'm going to read something. We understand how it's continuous for him, for Christopher to go here regardless. It's after the, you know, what's equivalent to the darkening of Valinor, and now we have the flight of the Noldor, right? Or the flight of the Noldoli. All right, so this roughly corresponds to chapter 9 of the Silmarillion. And let's read a little bit of the content here. Nonetheless, the gods did not give up hope, but many a time would meet beneath the ruined tree of Lorelin and thence break and scour the land of Valinor once more unwearingly. Unwearying, I guess, like unwearyingly, desiring fiercely to avenge the hurts done to their fair realm. And now the Eldar, at their summons, aided to the chase that labors not only in the plain, but toils both up and down the slopes of the mountains, for there is no escape from Valinor to west, where lie the cold waters of the outer seas. But Feanor, standing in the square about Inwë's house and topmost core, will not be silenced, and cries out that all the Noldoli shall gather about him and hearken, and many thousands of them come to hear his words, bearing slender torches, so that that place is filled with a lurid light such as has never been shown on those white walls. Now when they are gathered there, and Feanor sees that for the most part of the company is the kin of the Noldor, he exhorts them to seize now this darkness and confusion and the weariness of the gods to cast off the yoke. For thus demented he called the days of bliss in Valinor, and get them hence, carrying with them what they might or listed. Right, so apparently, you know, darkening of Valinor prior to that, and now Feanor is trying to lead some of the elves elsewhere, right, back to the lands in which they began. So a little bit of commentary from Christopher for this one. All right, he says, in this tale, in reality, the conclusion of the long tale of the theft of Melko and the darkening of Valinor, told by Lindo and finished by Rumil, is found the oldest account of the departure of the gnomes out of Valinor. Here the gods continue the vain pursuit and search long after Melko had escaped, and moreover are aided in it by the Eldar, including the Solusimpi, who, as the later Teleri portrayed in the Silmarillion, would hardly have left their shores and their ships. Feanor's return to Kor and his haranguing of the Noldoli, and in this account others, by the light of their torches, is seen to be an original feature. But his sons have not yet appeared, nor indeed any of the Noldoran princes descended from Finwë, save Turando, who later would become known as Torgon, of whom it is specifically stated that he was not yet upon the earth. There is no Oath of Feanor, and the later story of the divided councils of the Noldor appears only in the attempt of Noleme, Finwë, to calm the people. Noleme thus playing the latter part of Finarfin. So no Oath of Feanor in the original Book of Lost Tales. Another really interesting little thing is
that's
that...
That's kind of huge.
Yeah, pretty significant.
Yeah.
Another interesting difference just in name, is that the Teleri, who of course the third group of the elves, and who, you know, of course, who are the victims of the kinslaying, they are actually called the Solo Simpi in the original, which is...
That's also a big change.
Yeah, very big change. Yeah, very big change there. So,
huh. Interesting.
Yeah, so that's chapter 7. Moving on to chapter 8. Chapter 8 is the tale of the sun and moon. This corresponds, of course, to chapter 11 of the Silmarillion. And Greta, do you want to read the introduction here?
Sure. All
right.
The tale of the sun and moon is introduced by an interlude, as it is called in the manuscript, in which there appears as a guest at Mar Vanwa. You're going to have to help me.
Marvanwa Tialiva. Tialieva.
One Gilfanon of Tavrobel. Tavrobel? This interlude exists also in a rejected earlier version. The tale itself is for most of its length a manuscript in ink over an erased penciled original, but towards its end, see note 19, it becomes a primary manuscript to ink with the penciled draft extant in another book. The tale of the sun and moon is very long, and I have shortened it in places in brief paraphrase without omitting any detail of interest. A note of my father's refers to this tale as in need of great revision, cutting down, and ?
Hmm.
Hmm.
So reshaping? This was like
woo. So this was definitely a rough draft.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was almost sounds like maybe it was just a stream of consciousness.
Well, sometimes that's the best way
sometimes
to get
it
going.
Is, you know,
get the creative juices flowing. Mm-hmm. All right, a little representative snippet from this chapter. Knowing now, therefore, something of the glorious fashion of their ancient home and of the splendor of the gods, he pondered often on the coming of the days of sunlight and of moonsheen and of the doings of the elves in the world without, and of their adventures there with men ere Melko compassed their estrangement. Wherefore, one night he said, sitting before the tail fire, "Whence be the sun and moon, O Lindo? For as yet have I heard only of the two trees and their sad fading, but of the coming of men or of the deeds of the elves beyond Valinor has no one told me." Now there happened that night to be present a guest both all their board and at their tale-telling, at their board and at their tale-telling, and his name was Gilfanan, and all named him beside Gilfanan a Davrobel, for he came from that region of the isle where stands the tower of Tavrobel beside the rivers. And about it dwelt the gnome folk still as one people, naming the places in their own tongue. That region was Gilfanan wont to name the fairest of all the isle, and the gnome ken its best folk, albeit ere the coming of the folk thither long had he dwelt away from the Noldoli, faring with Ilkorins in Hisolome and Artanor, and there too had he become as few elves did a great friend and companion of the children of men of those days. To their legends and their memories he added his own knowledge, for he had been deep versed in many lores and tongues once in the far days of Kor, and experience had he beside of many very ancient deeds, being indeed one of the oldest of the fairies and the most aged that now dwelt in the isle, albeit Meryl held the title of Lady of the Isle by reason of her blood. Therefore said Lindo now, answering Eriol, "Behold, Gilfanan here can tell thee much of such matters, and it were well if you fared hence away with him to sojourn a while in Tavrobel. Nay, look not thus," he laughed, seeing Eriol's face, "for we do not banish thee yet. But of a sooth, he who would drink of Limpe were wise first to seek the guest kindliness of Gilfanan, in whose ancient house, the House of the Hundred Chimneys, that stand nigh the bridge of Tavrobel, may many things be heard of, both past and that are to come." All right, so... I mean, a lot of frame narrative there.
A new character, so that's fun.
Yeah, for sure. A little commentary from Christopher, a little snippet of commentary from Christopher here. He says, "In the next part of the tale, much light is cast on my father's early conception of the powers and limitations of the great Valar. Thus, Yavanna and Manwë, brought to this realization by Yavanna, are shown to believe that the Valar have done ill, or at least failed to achieve the wider designs of Iluvatar. I have it in mind that this time of darkness is not without the desire of Iluvatar. The idea of selfish, inward-looking gods is plainly expressed. Gods content to tend their gardens and devise their devisings behind the mountains, leaving the world to shape itself as it may. And this realization is an essential element in the in their conceiving the making of the sun and moon, which are to be such bodies as may light not only the blessed realms, an expression which occurs here for the first time, but all the rest of the dark earth. So, he says, of all this, there is only a trace in the Silmarillion. These things the Valar did, recalling in their twilight the darkness of the lands of Arda, and they resolved now to illumine Middle-earth and with light to hinder the deeds of Melkor. Yeah, so a lot more commentary from him. Interesting, very interesting commentary, if I might say, but a little snippet there for you. So,
yeah, it makes me wonder, is there a version of this series or these Book of the Lost Tales without his commentary in them? Like, it's just one continuous narrative?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Not like an official version. Maybe somebody somewhere has done that. But
no. I mean, nothing against it. I just, sometimes you just want to read the story.
Yeah.
You know? That's just my personal.
Well, you can do that too. He does his best to mark out like what's just, you know, what's commentary and what's not, right?
Right. That's true. That's true. Yeah.
It's not always 100% clear, but most of the time it is.
Yeah.
All right. And then there's a poem in this chapter, at the end of this chapter as well, that's affixed here. Christopher says, so this poem is called Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon, right? And so this, you know, so this is in The Lord of the Rings. I think it's Sam that recites something like this poem. Though it may be Frodo. It's one of the hobbits. I just can't remember which one. But Tolkien, or Christopher says about this poem, he says, the poem about the man in the moon exists in many texts and was published at Leeds in 1923, long after and much changed it was included in The Adventures of Tom Bombadil. I gave it here in the earlier published form, which was only a little retouched from the earliest workings, where it has the title Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon, an East Anglian fantasy. In the first finished text, the title is A Fairy, Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon, together with one in Old English, Se Monkening. So, there you go.
All right.
Looks like an interesting poem. Won't read it now, but
it has a fun title, so.
For sure.
I bet the poem's cool, too.
Chapter 9 is The Hiding of Valinor. Corresponds to Chapter 11 of The Silmarillion. Do you want to read that little introduction there, Greta?
Sure. The link to this tale, which is told by Verrier, has been given at the end of the last page 219. The manuscript continues, as in the latter part of the tale of the sun and moon, see page 220, note 19, with an earlier draft also extant, to which reference is made in the notes.
Mm-hmm. All right. So a little bit, little snippet of content here. Lo, tales I tell of the deep, and the first is called The Hiding of Valinor. Already have ye heard, said she, of the setting forth of the sun and moon upon their wayward journeyings, and many things are there to tell concerning the awakening of the earth beneath their light. But hear now of the thoughts and deeds of the dwellers in Valinor in those mighty days. Now is to tell that so wide were the wanderings of those boats of light that the gods found it no easy thing to govern all their comings and their goings as they had proposed at the first. And Ilinsor was loath to yield the heaven to Irwindi, and Irwindi set sail often before Ilinsor's due return, being eager and hot of mood. Wherefore were both vessels often far afloat at one and the same time, and the glory of them sailing most nigh to the very bosom of the earth, as often they did at the time, was very great and very terrible to see. So, a little bit of commentary on this chapter from Christopher. So, let's see. Get my page right. Here we go. He says, in the Silmarillion, there is no vestige of the tumultuous council, no suggestion of a disagreement among the Valar, with Manwë, Varda, and Olmo actively disapproving the work and holding aloof from it. No mention equally of any pleading for pity on the Noldor by Olmo, nor of Manwë's disgust. In the old story, it was the hostility of some of the Eldar towards the Noldoli, led by an elf of Kopas, Alqualandë, who likewise disappeared utterly. In the later account, there is never a word about the feelings of the elves of Valinor for the exiled Noldor. That was the starting point of the hiding of Valinor. And it is most curious to observe that the action of the Valar here sprang essentially from indolence mixed with fear. Nowhere does my father's early conception of the Fainéant gods appear more clearly. He held, moreover, quite explicitly that their failure to make war upon Melko then and there was a deep error, diminishing themselves and, as it appears, irreparable. In his later writing, the hiding of Valinor remained indeed, but only as a great fact of mythological antiquity. There is no whisper of its condemnation. So, apparently, you know, there's a lot, maybe the hiding of Valinor in the original conception had a lot more action and controversy surrounding it. So, perhaps one day we shall know more. So, yes.
Okay.
Good. Right on.
How would we know more?
Well, I'm just saying when we go back and eventually, like, you know, deep dives
and
all this stuff.
Oh, actually, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Okay. Well, that would be cool.
All right. And then the last chapter of the Book of Lost Tales 1 is entitled Gilfenan's Tale, The Travail of the Noldoli and the Coming of Mankind.
This is the same Gilfenan that...
From Chapter 8.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
He became the narrator in Chapter 8.
Got it. Okay.
I just will say about this chapter that it's very confusing to understand exactly what it is. I spent a good amount of time trying to kind of wrap my head around it. But I will give you this little snippet of Christopher's commentary, which attempts to explain it. So here we go. He says, the text just described, linking the hiding of Valinor to Ilios' unwritten tale, was not struck out, and my father later wrote on it, to come after the tale of Iarendil and before Ariel faces fares to Tavrobel. After Tavrobel, he drinks of Limpe. This is puzzling, since he cannot have intended the story of the coming of men to follow that of Arendil, but it may be that he intends only to use the substance of this short text, describing the Turuhalme ceremonies without its ending. However this may be, he devised a new framework for the telling of these tales, though he did not carry it through, and the revised account of the arranging of the next tale-telling has appeared in the tale of the Sun and the Moon, where after Gilfanan's interruption it was agreed that three nights after that on which the Sun and Moon and the hiding of Valinor were told by Lindo and Vire, there should be a more ceremonial occasion on which Gilfanan should relate the travail of the Noldoli and the coming of mankind. Gilfanan's tale follows on with consecutive page numbers from the second version of Vire's tale of the hiding of Valinor, but Gilfanan here tells it on the night following, not 3 days later. Unhappily, Gilfanan was scarcely better served than Ilos had been, for if Ilos scarcely got started, Gilfanan stops abruptly after a very few pages. What there is of his tale is very hastily written in pencil, and it is quite clear that it ends where it does because my father wrote no more of it. It was here that my father abandoned the lost tales, or, more accurately, abandoned those that still waited to be written, and the effects of this withdrawal never ceased to be felt throughout the history of the Silmarillion. The major stories to follow Gilfanan's, those of Baron and Tunuviel, Turin Turimbar, The Fall of Gondolin, and The Necklace of the Dwarves, had been written and in the first three cases rewritten. And the last of these was to lead on to the great tale of Arendil, but that was not even begun. Thus the lost tales lacked their middle and their end. And then he goes on to say, I give here the text of Gilfanan's tale so far as it goes. So, so there's a lot there, but this is kind of a marking off point, at least of the first part of the Book of Lost Tales, it would seem. So, yeah, but
and
I mean,
I am maybe appropriately so. I'm quite lost at this point.
I'm pretty lost too about that. But you know, I think if we, you know, when we do eventually go back and dive into these a little more, even though it'll take a good amount of brain work, but I think it'll start to become more clear what exactly we're doing. You know,
yeah, yeah,
and what's going on. So
okay. Good.
Nevertheless, with all this stuff, even if I'm not quite following it, I'm like, I want to understand what's going on. Like, I'm very interested to know more about, like, all these other characters that I've never heard of that Tolkien once conceived of.
I'll take you one step further and say that I want to understand.
Well.
So maybe you can get me there.
Yes. nested desire.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's
double
a
nested
very
desire.
Good way to,
yes.
to put it. Yeah. Okay.
That works.
Double nested desire.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Boom. So there you have it, a survey of the Book of Lost Tales 1. We are now 1/12 of the way through our survey of the history of Middle-earth.
Yay! Yeah. Wow.
So what we have discovered in the Book of Lost Tales 1 is roughly equivalent to the first 12 to 15 chapters of the Silmarillion in its published form. So what are the great tales of Beleriand? Well, we will discover the origins of those on the next episode as we dive into Volume 2 of the History of Middle-earth, the Book of Lost Tales 2. So,
alrighty, Rudy. Well, there
sound
we go.
Good?
That sounds good.
All right. Well, let's let's talk a little correspondence here.
All right.
So wanted to call out a awesome tweet we received here on March 18th. This is from JP Stevens at Jacob_Stevens17. He says, Tolkien Road, may I say how incredibly encouraging your podcast has been to helping me make it through lockdowns this year and the last. Long story short, but your Tolkienian spirit in a time of crisis was the oomph I needed to get out of the front door of my own hobbit hole. To go do that thing while hard, was so worth it. Having that hobbit-like spirit of facing down fear because it's worth doing carried me through the process of arranging an overseas move and starting on a ministry training scheme here in England.
Wow.
So from one traveler to another on this long road through life, I want to say thank you. It's been lovely having you as a companion for this little while.
Wow. That's cool.
Well, thank you
so
much.
That's really, really cool.
Yeah, thank you, JP. We really appreciate, you know, sharing that with us.
Yes,
and
very much.
It's always just awesome to hear somebody share something that's this, like that, that this little old podcast has affected them, you know, so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And, and as we always say when we receive these kind of things, you know, this this is another gust of wind in our sails, right, to keep doing what we're doing. So we really appreciate it and hope you'll keep in touch.
Yes. Yeah, please do. That's really cool. Really, really cool.
All right. We also have a note, our latest note from Marilyn the librarian. Marilyn, and the subject is lovely. She says, hello, Carswells. Your first episode on the Book of Lost Tales reminded me of how much I enjoy it and how much poignant early material is there. I think Edith was much more present in these earliest writings and not simply because she wrote out the first few stories. Interesting.
Oh, that is.
Greta, I'm not at all surprised that you were thinking of Peter Pan.
Oh.
Tolkien saw the play version of it when he was 18 in April of 1910. Carpenter says Tolkien wrote in his diary of that performance, indescribable, but shall never forget it as long as I live. Wish Edith had been with me. And John Garth wrote in Tolkien and the Great War, great war soldiers were weaned on Andrew Lang's fairy tale anthologies and original stories such as George MacDonald's The Princess and the Goblin, and fairy stock had surged with the success of Peter Pan, a story of adventure and eternal youth that now had additional relevance for boys on the threshold of manhood facing battle. Tin Fang Warble had a contemporary visual counterpart in a painting that found a mass market in Kitchener's army, the early volunteer army of the UK in World War I. Eleanor Canziani's Piper of Dreams, which proved to be the belated swan song of the Victorian fairy painting tradition, depicts a boy sitting alone in a springtime wood playing to a half-seen flight of fairies. In the trenches, the Piper of Dreams became, in one appraisal, a sword of talisman, because so many soldiers had a photo of the painting. So it wasn't just Tolkien and Lewis who were attentive to the call of fairy tales in the midst of the trenches. And then she links to the Canziani painting, which I will try to remember to put in the show notes. And Greta, I think you're connecting Tin Fang Warble to Tom Bombadil is a terrific catch.
Here's
a link to a fascinating essay by Roger Echo Hawk, who makes the same connection and also describes similarities between Tom and a Skeety Pawnee, American Indian traditional figure. And I will also link to that. And she says, and a greeting to a fellow listener. Hi, Durinair.
I'm excited to see how this goes.
Suomalainen Ustava.
Oh. Is that Sindarin?
I don't know what that is.
Or Finnish.
But I'm assuming that Marilyn and Durinair will know what that is.
And look how well Marilyn knows you, that she actually wrote out the pronunciation.
She sounded it out for me.
She's awesome.
I think sometimes that people like to send us notes with these, like, you know, with all these crazy... words just to like
just to they, hear you try they,
just
because
they get a tickle out of us trying to say these things.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there's more to it than that, but I'm okay with that. I get kind of a tickle out of it too, so
as
you know,
do I.
yeah so I think I said that right. Let me try one more time. Hi, Durinair, Suomalainen Ustava.
Yeah, that was better than the first time.
Yeah all right.
Yep, making progress.
Boom.
Okay.
A couple more things from Marilyn. She says, Over the Hills and Far Away is originally an English children's nursery song.
Mm.
And here I thought it was originally a Led Zeppelin song.
Unbelievable, man. John.
It'll kind of always be an originally an 11. Because I love that. I mean, it's a jam. But anyway, here are some lyrics from Wikipedia. Tom, he was a piper's son. He learnt to play when he was young, and all the tune that he could play was Over the Hills and Far Away. Over the hills and a great way off, the wind shall blow my top knot off. Tom, with his pipe, made such a noise that he pleased both the girls and boys. They all stopped to hear him play Over the Hills and Far Away.
Yes. Cool.
I just leave me wondering what it means that the wind shall blow my top knot off.
Well, we need to know what a top knot is.
Yeah, I just hope that's not some important piece of clothing. So
it sounds like it's maybe a hat.
Maybe that's it. Yeah.
Hopefully. Yes. Hopefully it's a hat. It sounds like it could be a hat.
Right.
Because, you know, like women put like their hair in buns on the top of their head and looks kind of like a knot.
Yeah. Okay.
So maybe that's what it is.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Word.
Yeah.
I'll take that. Okay. That's probably what it is.
Probably.
Yeah.
That would be the most appropriate thing.
Definitely anyway. More appropriate.
Yeah.
And then another link. So Marilyn.
Oh, to the lyrics. Cool.
Yeah. Marilyn dropping the link bombs on us. So I got to remember to put these all in the show notes.
Good stuff.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. She said, yes. Looking forward to the next episode, Marilyn. Yeah. Again, thank you, Marilyn. Always great to hear from you.
Absolutely.
And thank you for dropping cool knowledge bombs on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always. For sure. And making me realize I'm actually not crazy. Or really crazy.
Yeah.
Just the right amount of crazy.
Well, I agreed with you on that note, too. I thought that was a good catch. Yeah, on the Tom Bombadil thing and Tin Fang Warble.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thanks.
And also, Marilyn, just thanks for giving our listeners a chuckle by making me have to pronounce words that are really hard for me to pronounce. So.
In the language that we don't even know what it is.
Know what it is.
Yes.
All right. Good stuff. So
Absolutely.
We'd love to hear from any and all of you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, wherever it is. So, and I still got a lot I need to catch up on. So bear with me. Trying to get it knocked out as I can. So.
You need to figure out who was thinking along the same lines as me.
I can't believe I didn't save that one.
I can't believe it either.
Where did I get that? Where did
I get
that?
If you wrote that in.
Maybe it was I think it was a text. Oh, you know, that's what it was. That's what it was.
Text.
Somebody texted me. Now everybody's like, well, I don't have your text message.
I know, right? No, everybody's going to want to have your text.
Yeah, so this is from longtime listener Clay D. And he said, and he sent me this on Wednesday, so just like 2 days ago. He said, first of all, he sent a really nice note. He said, I listened to your two most recent episodes this morning. Sorry to hear about the passing of your father. Praying for you all. I lost my mother many years ago, so thank you for that, Clay. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to say, unrelated note, I thought the same exact thing as Greta regarding the exercise book.
So, awesome. Yes.
So there you go.
Yes. Right. Okay. Clay and me, we're just like, you know. On the same wavelength.
On the same page. Mm-hmm. On the same page.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And well, and I told him, and I did tell him, I was like, now since both of you thought that, you got me thinking I may be wrong. So maybe I'm wrong.
It happens more often than you care to admit.
Probably not, though.
Yeah.
All right. On our next episode, we will continue our survey of the history of Middle-earth with the Book of Lost Tales, Dose.
Part deux.
Part deux.
Mm-hmm.
That's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following: Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Lee Sue,
Andrew T,
John R,
Ms. Anonymous,
Shannon S,
Brian O,
Emilio P,
Zeke F,
James A,
James L,
Chris L,
Chuck F,
Azia V,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D,
Eric S,
Joey S,
Eric B,
Matt L,
Johanna T,
Sam N,
Mike M,
Nurenayir,
Robert H,
and Paul D.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you, guys.
And we will talk at you next time.
Don't forget.
Oh, yeah. As well as the celebrating their anniversary in March. Caitlin of Tea with
Caitlin.
Tolkien.
Caitlin. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you
Thank
so
you
much.
Thank you to all of you. I feel like we're playing a game of hot potato there. Like,
yeah.
Listing off the names is fun. It's good.
Keeping us on our toes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, y'all.
Yes, thanks, guys.
We'll talk at you next time.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.